Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Peter Riddle. I'm the director of the Institute for Government. Welcome to a very special comparative event. And we couldn't get more comparative than New Zealand and the UK. On that, I'll explain to Bill English, the audience has a number of serving civil servants, people who monitor the behaviour of the civil service, and a few retired civil servants, as well as those interested in issues involving public service. So you've got the ideal audience for your message on this. We're particularly glad to welcome Bill English, the Minister of Finance, Deputy Prime Minister in New Zealand, who has a wide-ranging public sector reform brief, as you'll see from the Better Public Services, which is the theme of a key programme which has been launched by the New Zealand government. He arrived in the UK today. He had meetings with Francis Maude, who is very familiar to us. I think I'm trying to work out how many speeches you've made, Francis, at the Institute this year. But we're delighted you're our venue of choice. Particularly glad because today's event unites not only the comparison of UK and New Zealand and vice versa, as we emphasise in our title, of learning experiences. And it's very interesting, having seen the presentation we're going to hear from Bill English in a second, how parallel many of the issues are. They're remarkably similar in many ways, albeit given a slightly local slant. Because two of the key issues we address at the Institute for Government are, one, how do you achieve reform? It runs through all the work we're doing. We're producing a report in about a month's time on transforming departments, where a number of people in this audience have been involved in the work on that, following our work with a number of government departments, and that will be launched about 5 weeks' time. Also, an accountability project, which is a year-long project we've been running. We started, and we decided to start with looking at the experience in New Zealand. We're also going to look at the experience in Australia there, and with this event, another event we're running next week, and also various other work we're doing to publish a briefing paper on that. This is very much, I regard, as in parallel with the work Francis has commissioned on the policy fund with IPPR. I've said to IPPR we were delighted to share our work with them, which we're going to do. Guy Lodge, who's doing it, isn't here because he's up at the Labour conference, but very welcome to do that. We decided not to bid, as is known, because we already had our project underway and we wanted to preserve the timetable and the independence of that. But that doesn't mean we're not behind the intention to do the research on that, and we will be doing it ourselves. Now, I'd like to, the order will be, first Bill English will speak, then Francis Maude, then I will raise a couple of topics. It's going to be a fairly tight timetable because the Minister's got to get away, he's got a very crowded programme, but he's going to start with a presentation of the reform agenda, particularly in the tight fiscal context in New Zealand, which I think, as I say, will have many echoes here. Bill English.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to what in New Zealand would be a very large audience for public policy. Having flown 30 hours to get here and gone straight to the Minister's office, we've plunged right in. We're spending a few days here covering public sector reform, also talking to our lenders, because we're selling New Zealand government bonds here. And I have the good fortune also to have a daughter attending university here, but mercifully protected from the impact of tertiary fees increases because of the beneficence of the Girdlers Society,
okay,
who for 80 years have every year paid for a young New Zealander to attend Cambridge University. So better public services. I'm not sure how the buttons are going to work here, but let's see. Oh, something's not going. I don't know who's in charge of this. Can someone make this thing work?
Yep.
It's always the same, isn't it? Look, the context for these pressures on public... Which one? That one there? On public service are very similar in the UK and in New Zealand. The one single difference is that our total level of government debt is considerably lower than here. Like for like, our net debt is going to peak at around 30% of GDP, and I think here it's somewhere in the region of 70 to 80. So the light at the end of the tunnel is a wee bit closer in our cases. In our case, government set a bunch of priorities earlier in the year. We've spent quite a bit of time getting clarity. The public are in a very pragmatic mood in New Zealand. They understand the world's changed. They understand their behaviour is changing, and government is. And we've been able to, therefore, have quite a, had a sort of non-controversial, strong focus. The one other difference between the UK and New Zealand is we have to rebuild our second largest city. It's had certainly had an impact on our fiscal aggregates, but just to give you a sense of the size of it, the capital cost of the rebuild is equivalent of about 12% of GDP, somewhere around $20 billion. We've got moderate growth, which helps an awful lot. We are in a less urgent situation than the UK, so we're expecting a growth path of 2 to 3%. Our Treasury, like yours, is persistently gloomy and always telling us it's going to get worse. I fear they might be somewhere near right this time. So that's why the line is coming down. But that's a very helpful background. A fair bit of that is the earthquake rebuild. As you can imagine, a project of that size is going to have a big impact. Our household debt is considerably worse than here. In fact, it's among the worst in the developed world. You can see it peaking there at about 150% of GDP. That is up there with Spain and Portugal. That is why we get around the world talking to our lenders, to make sure that they know that they're going to get their money back. We do not want to be someone who falls into the category where they think they might not get their money back. And the yields on government bonds are the lowest they've been in 40 years, so we're on the right side of the equation. We want to stay there. So our problem is much more household and private sector debt than it is government debt in the long run. But we have the same kind of deleveraging dynamics going on. We've got to get back to surplus. That's government debt. The net debt, that's a bit higher. I don't know why they've got 35%. It's actually going to peak at 30%. They've added something else in there. We set out pretty early on, in a different political context than here. We got elected just after the Lehman's crash. In fact, we launched a large tax package on the Thursday, and Lehman's crashed on the Friday. So we were somewhat caught short. We were elected from opposition on a very moderate platform. So despite the fact that the world changed between the start of the election campaign and it being elected, we decided to keep faith with our promises. And that has presented us with a particular challenge around public services. And it's forced us to take a different point of view than just getting cash savings out, because the public were not had no expectation of that that kind of situation. So we focused on maintaining and improving public services, not cutting them. And we said that right from the start. We're going to have more for less, not less for less. And it has been a fairly powerful guide to the politicians. So it's forced us to get clarity on our government goals, focus on better services, not less services. And, of course, that all needs stronger leadership. And I'm sure your public service is similar to here as it was in New Zealand. The skill set that was built up to 2008 turned out to be almost irrelevant to the circumstances past 2008. And if I could characterise those slightly unfairly, the public service got very good at managing up, that is, sucking money out of the system through ministers, and not very good at all at managing down, that is, understanding their organisations and what the hell they were doing, let alone whether they were achieving anything. We have taken a pretty strongly collaborative approach. Now, I outlined there efficiency, dividends and so on. None of that is particularly new, but a couple of key features of it have been these. One is spending a lot of time with chief executives as a collective, reflecting the fact that we operate collectively as ministers a lot, helped by the fact that all our ministers are in one building. So my day as the finance minister and deputy prime minister consists of mainly meeting with groups of ministers, usually accompanied by reasonably large groups of officials. So it's not unusual for us to have half a dozen ministers around the table and 15 officials. Clarity among the group about what they're trying to achieve. It creates peer accountability, and it leaves officials usually in no doubt about what is intended, so that they don't go off and spend months writing contesting bits of paper, that actually the decision's been made, they know where it's going. And increasingly we're using it as a problem solving process. So we go in with a problem on the table and we like to come out with the next steps that we're going to take, rather than using the formal decision-making process to achieve that. The second is the four-year budget plans, annual budget rounds. If you've got any choice about the amount of cash, then annual budget rounds are a nonsense for large, complex organisations. So we set out to ensure that the leadership of these organisations don't spend a whole lot of energy 4 months of the year trying to beat the budget system. So most of them have known since the 2010 budget what their revenue lines are for the next 4 years, and they will not change, and they are shrinking. So that's inclusive of their 3 or 6% efficiency dividend. So most of them have falling revenue lines, they're certain about those, and they have to meet the objectives but also manage their costs within those lines. We're not going back to take more off them, but they are not going to darken their door looking for more money. So in this next budget we will actually only negotiate with 3 ministers over their funding. The rest of it, it's up to them. Just a couple of examples to show how this is working a bit, because we're in year 4 now. Probably our most comprehensive change program is in the Defence Forces, which are usually the hardest nut to crack. Paramilitary monopolies and military monopolies are the hardest organisations to get change in. Police, cops, fire service, we all know that. What's worked here has been 2 things. One is the Defence Forces getting absolutely clear what they want, and that is the well-equipped frontline soldier. And that has meant they now don't think it's quite so important to have 3 separate administrative infrastructures for Army, Navy, Air Force. And so those have been collapsed. The second thing is forcing ministers to go through a lengthy, challenging and difficult strategic process. So making them think hard about what it is they really do want out of the Defence Forces. And we invested a lot of time in that, and having done so, the Defence Forces are now delivering very substantial change, large-scale savings, being reinvested. The Defence Forces will not get another dollar till 2017. They know what their funding is, and they're cutting overhead to get the funding to where they know it needs to go. Accident compensation, I'm not sure what it's called here, just to demonstrate the benefits of better management.
They don't have it.
They don't have it? Okay, so this is work accidents. So it's a social insurance scheme for work accidents. We inherited it losing billions. A very strong focus on simple things like getting the rehabilitation rate to improve rather than deteriorate. Stop writing law for wider entitlements but not put levies up. Means that now we are able to deliver what is effectively across the board tax cuts. Because everyone pays the ACC levy, it's a bit like your social insurance levies. And we're actually going to be able to reduce them over 2 or 3 years. Those reductions will be the equivalent of 1.5 to 2% of GDP. effectively a tax cut. We, having spent 2 or 3 years carving away at this, it became reasonably clear to us that these traditional problems, you know, cross-government activity, collaboration, you know, people live in families and communities, not government departments. You know, the parliamentary appropriation process determines how government does everything. It's nuts, really. Necessary, but pretty silly. And so we thought the only way to really drive front-end change is to take an old hackneyed tool, outcomes, which had never really been implemented properly in New Zealand despite it appearing in legislation 20 years ago, and put, in this case, particularly put the politicians to the test. Why would the public service take anything seriously unless we're willing to lay our political fortunes on the line for success? So we went through about a six-month process, mainly among ministers, actually, and then later with departments, to produce 10 result areas. And each one of these has a named chief executive who's responsible for them. So of the 10, and they're reasonably precise, we can say it's that minister and that chief executive. We have an election in 2014. The Prime Minister announced these. He has the power of appointment of the cabinet completely to himself, like you do here. And that is creating quite a strong focus, because ministers know they've got to deliver, and chief executives know that if they're not getting onto this very quickly, 2014 will be pretty chaotic, because they'll have the minister coming back to work in the middle of January saying, what the hell's going on? And numbers have got worse, not better. In some areas, we've got, most areas, these are building on success that's already in the pipeline. If I can just use the measures around reducing crime, nothing fancy here, we want to reduce reoffending rates, because they're very high in New Zealand. Crime rates are actually dropping about 5% per year now. That's partly demographic. It's also partly because we've now got a proper analysis of the law and order pipeline. And it's amazing how much difference it makes when you have a collective of police, courts and the prison service simply looking at what they're doing. You know, because it was the fastest rising cost in the government when we became the government. They were getting more money than they knew what to do with, more people than they knew what to do with. When that stopped and they started thinking harder about what they were doing, they've already had quite an impact. When we became government, we were told we'd need 2 or 3 new prisons. We said, no, we'll build one more, that's it. And for the first time in a generation, we're actually going to close prisons before Christmas. And we've taken a lot of notice of the welfare debate in the UK. What we've done here is create a notional insurance idea. So we've calculated a long-term liability for our current stock of people on benefit, 12% of working age New Zealanders, build up of hardcore, just like here, disabilities, disability benefits and so on. And the chief executive of MSD, which is equivalent of your work and pensions department, will have a performance agreement that says the current liability is $78 billion. Your job is to get it down. So that is in his agreement. This process is underway now. It's an example of something I'll point out at the end. There's a justice one. We'll flick through that. This is a survey that's run every year. I think mainly because of our rhetoric, but partly because of the delivery, public satisfaction with public services is rising, not falling, as we cut the budgets. One of the key aspects of this, though, is that it's become, because we've taken a longer term point of view, we're able to align our fiscal objectives with those of the community. So I'm now going around saying, as ministers increasingly are, the right result for the community is the right result for our books. That is one less prisoner reoffending, one less child abuse case, one more child getting through their 16-year-old qualification, one more young solo mum with a child actually under supervision with a responsible adult. Those are the things that are going to give us the benefits. And particularly in the welfare reform, we are actually spending more money now, not less, but we believe the payoffs for that are going to be quite large over the next 4 or 5 years. So we are going to have the core government expenditure, it's not on there, the core government expenditure is going to drop from 35% of GDP to 30% of GDP over the next 5 years. And I think by year 4 or 5, it will still be dropping because of the investment we've made now in better services. And that is one reason why the fiscal approach is supported generally across political parties, because they see it starting to deliver actual benefits to their communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Minister. It's absolutely fascinating.
I think there are a few things there which Francis might like, particularly those at the beginning of the talk about growth rates and so on, and levels of debt. Now, Francis Moore.
Well, thank you very much, indeed, Peter. And there's lots to be envious of there. I mean, a growth rate at 2 to 3%. That'd be nice. At debt levels at 30% of GDP. We settle for that. But actually, what's fascinating about that is how many points of comparison and similarity there are in the approaches, which is why I think the comparison is so interesting. Our systems coming from the same heritage, the same background, the same legal system, all of that gives them so much for us to draw from each other, and certainly had a fascinating talk with the Deputy Prime Minister earlier. The title of this discussion, Creating Better Public Services, I was really interested, but the Deputy Prime Minister's sort of strap line is more for less. And there's kind of a tacit defeatist assumption, really, that you can't get more for less. I remember many years ago, I was a Treasury Minister. We created something called the Citizens' Charter, which was the first attempt, really, in the British government to have some measurement of the quality of public services. And there was what I always felt to be a slightly defeatist sort of tacit conspiracy within the government, which was spending departments saying, don't encourage us to improve the quality because unless you're going to give us more money. And the Treasury saying, don't ask them to improve the quality of their service or they'll demand more money. The idea that you can actually get more for less, better quality public services for less, was kind of alien. And yet the environment in which we're in today not only makes it necessary, but shows daily how it's possible. I'll say a little bit about some of the things we're doing from the centre of government to drive cost out of government services. But, I mean, obviously the background is a common one. The public's demand for, in terms of the quality, the expectations in terms of the quality and the convenience of public services is rising all the time, year by year. People can avail themselves of services within the ordinary daily lives that they buy from the public, from the private sector, which get better, not universally, not in a straight line, but year after year get better and more convenient. We haven't been delivering in nearly enough places that in the public sector. And of course, the other part of the background is there isn't any money. We have hideous levels of debt, a bigger deficit than anywhere else in the had a bigger deficit than anywhere else in the developed world, and so we're obliged to deliver more for less. And of course, public spending cuts generally are unpopular, but actually the public spending cuts which are about driving cost out of government are popular. People think that's a good thing to do, and they want to see their money spent better. And our starting point was that over the last years, while productivity in the private services sector rose by nearly 30% in Britain, in the public sector it was at best static. And if productivity in the public sector had risen by a comparable amount, the position, both our economic position, because that in itself is a huge drag on economic growth and economic performance, but the fiscal position would be radically different. And so driving cost out to drive up productivity is of absolutely fundamental importance. And it was against this background that we developed what we call, I believe, consultants. We don't employ consultants anymore in government, but it's what they would call it if they were allowed in. The loose-tight balance. And in any big, complex, dispersed organization like a government or maybe a multinational corporation, there are some things you control militantly from the center. You would control, obviously, strategy and strategic communications and cash, kind of. You would control big projects that carry operational and financial reputational risk. You control property. You wouldn't allow one bit of the organization to make dispositions on property that damage the whole. You wouldn't allow the position where which we found in Bristol, for example, where central government in its different manifestations was occupying no fewer than 115 different addresses, with all the cost and the opportunity cost of separate working that comes with that. You would control ICT infrastructure so that there are common platforms of it, so that interoperability becomes the norm rather than, as it is now, the exception. You'd control broad HR operating standards. You'd buy common goods and services on an aggregated basis to leverage the volume that scale gives a government as a very big customer. And those are things you would control tightly. And the loose part is, because people often say, well, Francis, we hear a lot about the tight, when does the loose come in? The loose comes in actually by pushing responsibility for frontline delivery as close to the frontline as you can get. And one of the ways in which we're doing that is by encouraging the public service mutual model, where groups of public sector workers form themselves into an employee-led entity, which most of them are proving to be, by the choice of the staff, not for profit. Spin themselves out, deliver the public service on a contractual rather than a line-managed hierarchical basis with stupendous productivity improvements that can be delivered almost overnight, actually. And that's loose. That's actually people who the what of what they're delivering is formed in the contract. How they do it is up to them. And what people in public service mutuals consistently say is, we'd never go back and work for the council, the health authority, the government. Why not, you ask? Because we can do things. The model we're in, we can do things. We can see what needs to be done and we can do it. It's very powerful. And the can you deliver more for less? Is it just about those kinds of sort of human aspects of productivity? Those are powerful and achievable, and we're showing in different sectors already how they can be delivered. Payment by results models can start to deliver this as well, where services are commissioned on a payment by results model from outside providers. You can also these days find astonishing savings by going outside the old model of the usual suspect suppliers. I recently discovered an example where the incumbent ICT supplier for a part of government was bidding £4 million for a particular service to continue. A small challenger provider came in and offered to do it and has agreed to do it for £50,000 for not very much more than 1% of the incumbent's cost. Now, these are not modest savings. I mean, I'm not suggesting all of them. We'll get that every time, that'd be nice. But actually, you don't need many of those on a big scale to see stupendous changes, stupendous improvements. And so you start to see very real capital productivity increases alongside alongside labour, human productivity. And on the human side, we have issues with the need for, widely acknowledged in the civil service and in the leadership of the civil service, for reform. Now, it is now a kind of settled view, really, without contest, that every organisation under the sun is either getting better or it's getting worse. You don't always know that it's getting worse. You may think it's fine and it's going along on an even keel, but if you think that, in 2 years' time, you'll find that it's got worse. All organisations are getting better or getting worse. And if they're not getting better, they will definitely be getting worse. And our civil service in this country has many huge strengths, but it does need to reform and change to meet the challenges of the time, which are greater than anything we've seen. It's smaller today than at any time since the Second World War. It's fallen from around 500,000 civil servants when the coalition government was formed 2.5 years ago to around 420-something people now, and planned to fall by 2015 to 380,000 just in department's own plans. And this has meant, and Sir Bob Kerslake and Sir Jeremy Hayward have been really very clear about this, this imposes demands on the civil service to operate very differently and to transform and change. Yes, there is a demand for change from ministers, but also from civil servants themselves. And we do these annual people surveys, which have thrown up consistently concerns about performance management in the civil service, a culture that's overly bureaucratic, risk-averse, very hierarchical, which is much more about behaviour than it is about structure and organisation. And the focus there is too often, these are things civil servants themselves say, a focus on process, not on outcomes. So change is wanted. The public wants services to be delivered better. And this means efficiency and productivity have to continue to improve. And that's why Sir Bob Kerslake and I published the Civil Service Reform Plan that set out the first stage in our reform programme. It brings a series of range of practical reforms, none of them turning the system upside down, all of them really in themselves incremental, but if implemented, which they must be, will make it a civil service that is smaller, yes, flatter, faster. It'll be more digital. We need to be an organisation where, like British Airways, now a company where everything that isn't about flying aeroplanes is done online, which is better for the passenger and the customer, but much cheaper and more efficient as well. And we're light years as a government, as an organisation, behind that. Light years behind that. So more digital, more unified, a theme that Sir Bob Kerslake has stressed repeatedly. We don't manage our talent in a corporate, unified way. I talked about the ICT infrastructure, which emphasizes insularity of different bits of government against the interoperability. And so interesting to hear the Deputy Prime Minister talking about the model in New Zealand where ministers work together in the same building, focusing on the need for much more joined up government, something that all governments everywhere in all systems will talk about, and without ever there being a perfect solution. But one of the things that we need to see, as again widely recognised in the civil service, is to sharpen accountability. Our system works very properly on the basis that ministers are accountable to Parliament. That's absolutely right. And you will hear demands from in Parliament for senior civil servants to be more directly accountable to Parliament. That is not part of the way our system works, nor need it be. What our system requires is that civil servants are directly accountable to ministers. And in general, that works well. But in too many occasions, it hasn't been quite like that. And it isn't just ministers in the coalition government, but ministers in the last government as well. have too often found that decisions they've made do not then get implemented. It's not happening all the time. In most cases, it does happen, but too many cases where it doesn't happen. And there are cases where permanent secretaries have blocked agreed government policy from going ahead or advised other officials not to implement ministerial decisions. And of course, that's utterly unacceptable in our system. And of course, the damage that does to the system is that it undermines the excellent work that most civil servants do, dedicated public servants with imbued with that public service ethos that is so valuable. And of course, ministers should, and they're obliged to under the ministerial code, and indeed they'd be bonkers not to, seek and listen to the advice of their officials. A minister who didn't do that would be insane. And yet, once you've sought the advice and you've listened to it and you challenge and interrogate, and full opportunity for the everything around that decision to be properly examined and challenged. Once a decision's made, of course, the decision must be implemented. And ministers in our system, and I guess in the New Zealand system as well, come with very small personal staffs of people who are not civil servants. Indeed, for junior ministers, they have absolutely none at all. The entirety of their staff are civil servants. And it's simply not possible, nor should it be even necessary, to think about what would be involved for the minister himself or herself to try to track every single decision that's been made to check whether it's being implemented. You have to be able to assume that that's happening, because actually, at the end of the day, it's the minister who has to go along to the House of Commons and be interrogated and interviewed, as it's always so delightful, on the Today programme about the performance of their departments. And so we want to strengthen the accountability of the civil service. So we've announced we want to strengthen the role of ministers in the appointment of permanent secretaries. There are many ways in which this can be done. We want to clarify what's expected of every permanent secretary. So for the first time, we'll be publishing their objectives. And so it'll be clear what is expected to be delivered, and which will be very useful both actually for permanent secretaries in their own departments, because again, it'll be absolutely explicit what is being expected of the permanent secretary as the leader, the official leader of that department, as well as for the public. These will be agreed in advance with ministers and with the Prime Minister and updated periodically. We'll also be bringing in ways, which should happen routinely but doesn't always happen, for ministers to feed into the appraisals of civil servants whose work they see and whose work they have a close interest in. It should, say, happen as a matter of course, doesn't always. And it's very important that the appraisal of officials reflects the input of both ministers as well as their peers and their direct reports and the people they report to. So there's much that we need to do through the civil service reform plan. One of the ways in which we strengthen accountability, and we were discussing this with the Deputy Prime Minister earlier, is having much better management information. Management information produced on a directly comparable, consistent basis between departments is a fundamental tool for accountability. And it's not always very popular, and it was disappointing to find that in too many cases, departments were producing data on common areas of spend on a different basis, with different definitions. So you could never compare apples in one department with apples in another department, and too often the definitions changed, so you didn't have a consistent series, so you couldn't compare apples this year with apples last year. And yet with that consistent, comparable management information comes inescapable accountability. And the new senior non-executives we put in place under Lord Brown's leadership to strengthen the role of departmental boards in the governance of departments, to provide challenge and advice and supervision. A constant plea of theirs has been, which has been reflected also, I think, in the work of the Institute, Peter, a plea for better data, for better quality, comparable management information. And this has been a bit like pulling teeth to get progress here, but we have got progress and we will deliver that. All of this will make our system, I think, capable of improvement. None of it revolutionary, none of it to upset the overturn the basic Northcott Trevelyan system, which I've been a very strong and vocal supporter. But it has to move and change with the times to become, as we've said, flatter, smaller, faster, more digital, more unified, focus on outcome, not process, better managed with better performance management, with more accountability for delivery, and frankly, more fun to work for. Because actually, a lot of civil servants themselves express their frustration. And civil servants who feel themselves empowered and trusted to do their job and get on and make decisions and implement them are people who will be more productive and who will get more satisfaction from what they do. And that absolutely is a key part of it, with modern terms and conditions. And that doesn't just mean about pay and rations. Actually, it almost so means about workplaces that work for them, technology that works for them, and a holistic approach to the workplace, which actually supports productivity and creativity rather than denies it. So there's much for us to learn from New Zealand, which is why we've commissioned a study from IPPR specifically to look at the New Zealand model, but also the Australian, the Singapore, and others where there may be lessons for us to learn. And we're very much looking forward to learning more from you, Deputy Prime Minister. Thank you very much.
Before opening it out, can I ask you both, I mean, one of the interesting themes you were outlining very clearly, the objectives you set the chief executives of departments in various areas. You talked about defence, in law and order area. In terms of holding to account, who monitors the performance? And I'll switch that on to Francis as well. And how does that work, the actual process? Given you're doing it 4 years ahead, you express absolute clarity about what's going to happen in the 4 years, circumstances can intervene. So how are they monitored in a fair and consistent way?
Well, we've been looking for the right balance here between a system that can actually operate as opposed to a widespread compliance-driven high-cost system. So it's... In terms of the 10 results that the government's focusing on, that starts with the Prime Minister conducting a discussion with each minister every 6 months. And each year, those expectations are expressed in a letter from him to the minister. So that puts a pretty strong personal edge on it. And then the... Minister then, of course, is highly incentivised to transmit that through the department, and increasingly that does involve working with other ministers. So it's explicitly referred to in the accountability in the letters, and increasingly in the chief executive accountability documents, that they need to be seen as someone who is able to work with other people. Rather than someone who is seen to be unable to work with other people, even if it makes their department more powerful and influential in their eyes. Alongside that, we're working towards a kind of corporate head office type approach. So we have three central agencies. It's a bit different than the structure here, of which the Treasury is one, State Services Commission, and the Department of Prime Minister. Prime Minister's Department. So increasingly we're pushing them into, instead of a lowest common denominator among the agencies, what they can agree to, pushing them towards exercising judgment across the whole of government. So the most useful output from that process, from my point of view, is a traffic light system. So that cuts through all the statements of intent and all the annual cycle of the parliamentary stuff, which is not designed to actually allow you to manage anything. It's designed for democratic accountability. which is quite a different function from actually making any difference out in the community. But the corporate centre is now has to exercise judgment, right? So they showed me the traffic lights that say these three departments actually are under real stress. The ministerial relationships may not be working. They're not getting on top of their budget cycle, whatever. So that accountability is increasingly focused on judgment rather than compliance. And I think that's quite a critical mind shift, having people willing to say that's not working. Rather than people saying, well, we filled out the forms.
Yeah.
How do you see it working here? I mean, who's going to monitor? The permanent secretary set an objective. Who's actually going to monitor that?
Well, the performance manager of the permanent secretaries will be... Essentially, all permanent secretaries report either to the head of the civil service, most of them do, or to, in kind of line management terms, or to the cabinet secretary. Bob and Jeremy do their performance appraisals, they will draw heavily on what the Secretary of State says and ministers say, but also will involve heavily the, and this is where I think the role of the boards can be very important, the non-executive members of the board. But, you know, we should all be doing 360 degree appraisals these days. I've just undergone one. Undertaken by the Institute for Government, which was an interesting experience and a good one actually. I mean, it was very good. But so these things ought to be done, need to be done quite rigorously. And you know, the point that's constantly made by civil servants in people surveys, and anecdotally, that performance management has not been done consistently and rigorously, needs to apply at the top just as much as right throughout the organisations. And that's why having performance objectives for permanent secretaries, which are agreed, which are done in quite a rigorous way, and are then public, and then some matching of achievement against those objectives, is a much more transparent and rigorous way of doing it. But, you know, we are in the early stages of this.
Because another feature in New Zealand is the chief executives have a fixed-term contract, don't you? It's 3 or 5 years.
Five.
Because there was talk here that some permanent secretary appointments going back a few years were for a fixed term. Does that attract you?
Well, I mean, I think it's really difficult to do under our employment laws because you've got, I mean, certainly for internal appointments, because these are people who have employment rights and you can't suddenly kind of truncate them by putting a fixed term in. You can, and this does happen, with people who are brought in from outside. But I'm told, anyway, that it's not possible to bring in these kinds of fixed term arrangements for people who get appointed from within the civil service to senior roles.
Right, let's open it up to questions. We've got about a quarter of an hour for questions. If you keep them fairly tight, please. I'm going to go to public officials rather than journalists first, if you don't mind, Judy. Paul, at the back.
Thank you. Paul Evans, House Commons Clerk. Mr. English, these are two related questions really addressed to me. Mr. English, you've said more than once that there's a tension between the sort of appropriation system, parliamentary appropriation system, and delivering what you want to deliver. And I wondered if you were making any effort to reconcile that tension at all, whether you just thought it was an inevitable block. And Mr. Moore was very against the idea of civil servants being directly accountable to select committees in Parliament. Do you share his view on that?
On the first one, we're just going to pass some legislation over the next 6 months which are designed to give more elbow room within the structures that are dictated by the parliamentary appropriation process. And because if we want smaller, flatter, more effective, then you're going to need people in the system having more ability to shift the money around. We're willing to do that where the objectives are pretty clear. And probably not willing to do it in those parts of public service of which you have some where they're doing a job that's always going to have to be done. So yes, we're about to legislate probably the biggest changes since we first, since the big changes back in the late 80s, early 90s. But they will reflect practice to a large extent. I mean, we're already working more collectively, so the appropriation process needs to accommodate that. It needs to make it easy for ministers to walk into a room and in half an hour shift 10 million around and walk out and it's done. Right, without having to go through cabinet committees and cabinet and everything. Or even if that happens, it's after the fact rather than the decision-making process. Your second issue about direct accountability. Look, we're reasonably happy with where ours is. Ministers can have a pretty direct effect if they use the tools. And that's a general point I'd make about accountability, is our systems actually have the tools. Often the politicians don't use them, don't understand them. If they do the basic process stuff around being clear what they want and writing it down and then reading the thing from the department about whether they have actually gone and done it, then you can have a powerful effect. But there's no change in the rules will make it work if people don't use the basic tools. We think we've got enough of them. Inevitably there is tension though. It doesn't matter what the rules are, there'll be an argument over whether the official should turn up to explain it to the media or the minister. And we've gone, I think, swung back a bit more to ministers. There was a phase there where officials were pushed out, in my view, a bit too often. But I couldn't comment on the situation.
Francis, do you want to come in on this at all?
I think there's very interesting insight there. It is a different different nuance. I mean, we do not generally have civil servants who are publicly accountable. I'm not sort of dead set against more direct accountability of civil servants. But I think you can't kind of have it both ways. You can't have a position where ministers only are accountable to Parliament and publicly for what a department does without the ministers there having any ability to make a difference in the people who actually have to deliver the things for which the minister is accountable. I mean, if ministers are to be prevented from making a choice of the key appointment, which is the chief executive, the permanent secretary of the department, then I think the pressure for there to be much more direct accountability with probably much more kind of rigorous definition and description of the objective, the implementation objectives, which we are, you know, our system is not attuned to doing this. I think the pressure will become hard to resist.
Now let me take a couple together. Robert Hazel. No, I'll move along. Yep. One question, Robert, not two.
Just one. The one big difference in New Zealand is the State Services Commission. So quite a powerful central agency, in part responsible for managing the performance of senior officials, but also an independent agency which can help protect them from undue pressure. Can you tell us a bit more about the State Services Commission? And Francis, do you see any role for a more powerful but independent central agency here? Which bits of the State Services Commission are you tempted to borrow?
Right, well that's one very interesting one. Vernon Bognor there.
Seems to me there are two possible dangers to Francis Maude's ideas. The first is in the appraisal of civil servants. I think by contrast with the private sector, the civil service tends to be collective, and it's sometimes very difficult to disentangle the specific contributions made by individual senior civil servants. But second and more important, the greater role that ministers play in appraising officials and appointing senior officials, the greater the danger of officials becoming pliable to the interests of ministers and becoming more political. And if, as you say, that officials have not implemented government policy effectively, either in this government or the last, seems to me the answer to this is to bring in your own people, bring in expert special advisers who can oversee that problem of implementation. And that way, you preserve the barrier between the politicians and the civil servants who can give advice that sometimes ministers don't like.
Hi.
I just wanted to invite you to reflect on the difference between blocking, which you say senior civil servants are doing, blocking ministerial initiatives, and challenge. Because, you know, civil servants have responsibilities to challenge ministers when there's poor value for money, when things are infeasible, when they're irregular, or whether they're unlawful. And it's sometimes very hard in the public statements on this to get a sense of what you mean when you're complaining about it. And also, what's the legitimate behaviour that is challenging and an illegitimate behaviour that's blocking?
Okay, let me deal explicitly with that because it's a really important point. My objection is not to challenge. I encourage an environment where officials can give the most candid advice, and nothing I like more than an argument. What my complaint is not remotely about challenge. My complaint is actually the reverse. My complaint is where there isn't challenge, where where I'm not being told this is a terrible thing to do. I don't mind that at all. I will have that argument, I will interrogate the advice, and I will come to a view. And no minister who in their right minds would not do that. My objection is where there isn't challenge and a decision is made and then it doesn't happen. And then it kind of quietly fades into the long grass and nothing, it's never seen
any,
again.
Any examples, Francis?
Well, no, because it's not actually, it's invidious. I mean, there are plenty of examples. There are many, many, many more examples of decisions actually being implemented. And so I'm not saying this is anything like universal. But it's you can't give the examples without actually fingering individuals, which would be invidious. So it's a very different phenomenon. Challenge, excellent. That's exactly what you want. But it's when there isn't the challenge, but it doesn't happen. And that's actually, that's very corrosive of the system because it corrodes trust. You know, just to pick up Vernon's point about, I'm actually rather relieved here there are only two dangers in what I'm proposing. So he's a rather modest count. I use an interesting phrase, the danger of officials being too pliable to ministers' wishes. Well, actually, that is what the Civil Service Code says, that actually if ministers properly make a decision, a lawful decision, and they've followed the code and they've sought and listened to advice, it is actually the obligation of officials to deliver it, to implement it. If they don't, if there are proper objections, then there is the ability, which I wouldn't at all object to being deployed, of a permanent secretary and accounting officer saying to the minister, I think this is the wrong thing to do, and I will only do it if you issue a written direction. That's perfectly legitimate. And if the minister's confident enough in his or her judgment, having assessed the risks and the advantages and being willing to defend it and make the case, I would be perfectly willing for that to be followed. And these are all really proper ways in which our system can work and should work. What is corrosive is the kind of the passive, the non-challenge followed by non-compliance and non-implementation. And, you know, the truth is, we could have a system where ministers bring into office with them an army of kind of their own appointees who are there to double-check and enforce and follow up and so on. But actually, you're then imposing a kind of whole new approach, which shouldn't be necessary. It shouldn't be necessary. You know, there's a sort of view in sometimes in Whitehall that that special advisers are there only to put a sort of overlay of politics on an otherwise imperfect system. Actually, what special advisers spend most of their time doing is following up on things, seeing whether things have happened, not actually being political, but they're the only people in the department who have an undivided loyalty to the minister. And that's why this thing about appraisals is so important, because when you're doing things which are countercultural, which actually challenge the received wisdom in the system, And there can be, and I have known this, examples where officials have been put in a difficult position, where you know they have explicitly been given a choice. You know, who do you work for? Do you work for the minister? Do you work for the permanent secretary? And if it's only the permanent secretary who is and only civil servants who are contributing to the appraisal, then that's actually, it's not very difficult to see where the self-interest, and it's to the enormous credit, actually, of most civil servants that they will ignore all of that. But it's crucially important. Not that the final word lies with the minister. That would be wrong. But actually that there's a formal means for the minister to feed in views of the performance of individual civil servants and teams so that, the assessment of those individuals and teams can reflect those
teams. Prime Minister.
Pick up your State Services Commission. It is potentially quite a powerful entity, but in our system that's balanced by fixed-term contracts, and I don't think any New Zealand government would go back to permanent tenure. The five-year contracts are generally renewed, but not always. And secondly, there is provision there that if the relationship breaks down between the minister and the chief executive, it gets to the point where the minister says, well, actually, that person can't come in my office, then the State Services Commission has the responsibility for exiting, solving the problem. And occasionally it does that. So, and in the legislation we're going to be passing, we are going to give the head of State Services a bit more power to reach into the second and third levels across departments. And at the moment they do the chief executive appointments, which can be only vetoed by cabinet, which almost never happens. But in addition to that, they'll be able to reach down to help lubricate the leadership development process a bit more than we've had with departments being a bit too independent. But it is really important trade-off. The State Services Commission is independent. They do have to be involved in protecting public servants, and they are quite actively, but they're not. The Chief Executive does not have permanent tenure. And I think that's not a bad balance there.
Are you attracted by any elements of the State Services Commission, given you're moving into a different relationship?
I don't know enough about it. It's one of the things I want to understand much more. But I think there are lots of things where I think we just need to understand how it works better. What I think I'm picking up, and we want to really understand this more, is that I think there's more clarity in the way the New Zealand system works than there is in ours. That's, I think we need to understand that much more.
That's one of the things we'll be doing in our briefing paper next month. Time for two more questions. David. There's a mic coming for you. And I want to explain to Deputy Prime Minister that David Normington is our Civil Service Commissioner.
Yes, David Normington. Mr. English, I was fascinated by what you said. I just wanted to check something, though, which is you put up your five areas, sort of priority areas. Reducing crime was one, and I used to be a permanent secretary of the Home Office, so I'm interested in that one. And I think you said that ministers and the chief executive shared the objectives. Is there any attempt to separate what ministers are accountable for and what the civil servants is accountable for? Because many accountability systems in the public sector fail on this point, and I'm sceptical about how easy it is to say this is what politicians are responsible for and this is what civil service is responsible for, particularly in an area like reducing reoffending and reducing crime, where there are many and varied elements in reducing crime.
Initially, no. If you just take that example, by the time we came to outline in detail the objectives, which are largely around reoffending rates, we had already developed a very strong pipeline analysis and also collective governance. So the police commissioner, the head of justice, who happened to run the courts as well as other things, and the head of the prison service and their ministers are, from my point of view, effectively the justice board, and now we meet quarterly. So we haven't tried to make it refined in a constitutional sense. They all know what they're trying to do. They've arrived in this collective from different perspectives and positions. It's got a good, healthy internal tension about it. What they all know is that the minister knows they're going to be judged on whether they've achieved what they've published, and that happens to align pretty closely with the chief executives in each case. And that looks at the moment to be a fairly powerful alignment. Because I think once you start, as you go along, of course, we're going to argue over who did what and whether it made any difference. It's got the benefit in that case of starting on a wave of success anyway. Okay, they're already getting results. As we formalise it, that helps. But again, if I just pull back a bit, we're trying to get this thing running on judgment rather than compliance. So we're willing down the track to make the judgment. Did the police commissioner deliver? Now, you know, is there going to be a whole big paper trail to prove it or not prove it? Well, there may or may not be, let's see. So I suppose we're getting around that issue by not focusing on it, just saying we all, the way we develop the results, the public environment is such that there's been really no debate over the nature of what we're focusing on. It's been non-controversial, and really no debate over the fact that the government is going to be accountable. And that alignment is really, really important. And in some areas we've struggled to get that alignment, but we've got there, and we'll see how it goes.
Francis?
Well, I rather agree with David, actually. I think it's quite difficult to separate out, in terms of kind of the public service delivery outcomes, between what's actually the consequence of the policy and what's the consequence of the way it's implemented and delivered. I think our focus is much more on in relation to permanent secretary objectives, on the things which are plainly the responsibility of the permanent secretary to deliver, which will be things like on efficiency or major projects and so on, where it is the responsibility to kind of take that and make it happen. But I think it is not that easy. And I think one of the things that I've heard, and I'd be really interested to pursue this and understand it better in the New Zealand system, is when the contract is in place with particular kind of objectives in the chief executive's contract. Of course, in politics, as was famously said, you know, events happen and things change. And, you know, you can't have a kind of fixed 5-year view. It's like sort of planning a conversation with someone, and the first thing is they don't say what they're meant to say. And events happen that you're not expecting to happen. And so I think it's difficult to do this perfectly.
Yeah, it's difficult to do it perfectly, but, and I agree with that, what we've found is that if you allow the public service to drag you into a conversation about uncertainties, you'll agree on nothing and nothing will happen. And you'll end up layering up program after program that is the minister's fad, the latest whim, the last expert from the US, and no one ever says, did it make a difference to someone?
Yeah.
Our Minister of Education has brought a strong focus to this by turning up at individual schools saying, you've got to get 47 more kids over the line. Right? It's a radically different approach than the DNA of the Ministry of Education, which is to spend a decade improving the inputs and hoping that if you squeeze down hard enough from the top, something might pop out the bottom. So we have this little mantra, we know their names. And in a small country, you do. Right? We know the names of every young woman under the age of 18 who has a child. 2,600 of them. Less than in our larger secondary schools. So there's not much point in rabbiting on about the uncertainties of sexual health education, right, which has been an excuse for not engaging with these kids who have kids and protecting them from violence and drug addiction and transients. So we've kind of junked strategies because they're excuses, and uncertainties because they are real. They can be real, but they can be excuses for saying, I spent $350 million and nothing is any different. Okay? That's the bit we're trying to fight, is good intentions. Is all the good intentions, if you get away with it, if you say this, I've got great intentions, I've got all this cash that turned up from people paying $150 a week in their PAYE, pay as you earn tax. But there's so many uncertainties, you can't judge whether I made any difference. Just keep giving me the money. So hopefully we're swinging to one extreme and changing the system by saying, no, forget the uncertainties. These are the people you're responsible for. This is what you've got to do. And we'll spend the next, you know, so show me you're making a difference.
That strikes such a chord. I mean, every local authority in Britain knows which of the families, by name, which cost most amounts of public money. And in every local authority, it'll be somewhere between 50 and a few hundred. And they're the families with deeply entrenched intergenerational problems, where we have for decades been ineffectively managing the symptoms of failure. And actually focusing on, generally not by state action, but by outside agencies, often with payment by results, to tackling the underlying problems of those named families. Mm. The human and social benefits are immense, as well as financial benefits.
Well, thank you. I think on that note, can I thank you both? It's absolutely fascinating, the compare and contrast. And Francis, you know your objective to get the growth rate up to 2 or 3%.
Absolutely.
Get the debt. I mean, I'm slightly concerned you're satisfied with debt at 30%. You know, this is this defeatism on that. And thank you very much indeed, Deputy Prime Minister. Absolutely absorbing account. We're already doing lots of work here on New Zealand, and we are going to take that forward. And we're delighted to have you here, and I hope the rest of the trip goes very well indeed. And if I could ask you to join me in thanking very much for...